Can I say what I really mean this? What a pleasure it is to be up on the Central Coast every Monday. I've had an association with the Central Coast since I was 10, when my parents bought a holiday shack at McMaster's Beach, and we just went to the beach all Christmas and all Easter, and so it's always great to be back. I have five grandchildren, each of my grandsons, they're all up here. So I thought tonight, seeing I'm on the Central Coast, that I would start off with a Central Coast story, and a fishing story. And you might immediately think, well, with that kind of title, it's a talk about truth done by a journo, and he's going to kick off with a fishing story? You might think, what on earth is going on here? But I'm going to set a test. I'm going to tell you the fishing story, and it's your test to tell me whether it's true or not, okay? I've been a professional storyteller for more than four decades, as Steve said. But I want you to tell me whether this story is true or not. A couple of years ago, we're at the Saratoga Wharf. We know this very well, my grandsons and I, where we have caught lots of fish. We go on quantity, not quality. Lots of fish to catch on the Saratoga Wharf. But Reuben, the guy up the top there in the red hat, started more and more saying to him, to me, "Papa, can we get a keeper?" He's the hunter-gatherer at the age of seven. "Can we get a keeper?" And I said, "Reuben, look, I will give it a go, mate." So we picked the right day, 19th of March in 2016, late afternoon. The time's right, the tide's right, the day's right, the weather's right. And we start doing a drift up and down near the Rip Bridge, down near Woi Woi. And we caught nothing but pickets, no keeper for the whole afternoon. And we're about at last light, and Reuben's saying, "Oh, I've got another picker." But he said, "Oh, this one's getting really heavy." And I think, "Mate, just haul it in, let's go. It's late. It's been another useless day of fishing on Brisbane water. So if you've got any spots, let me know after." And he said, "Oh, but this is getting heavy." And I said, "Come on, Reuben, just haul it up. It's time to go." And I looked around, and the rod's going in the water like this. And I said, "Come on, mate, you know, put some muscle into it, haul it up." And I said to Tristan, his dad, my son, "Mate, you'd better get the net, just in case it's something." So Reuben brings whatever's on the line up, and there's this sudden thrashing on the water, and Tristan gets the net and scoops up three fish. A picker, a 58-centimetre flathead, and a 69-centimetre flathead. So the 58's on the picker, and the 69-centimetre flathead is following the 58-centimetre one. My brother-in-law, my son-in-law said, "You've just killed date night." And you could have heard the hooting and the hollering as we hauled these three fish into the boat, and we got these big flatties thrashing about on the bottom of the boat. You could have heard the hooting and the hollering from here to Woi Woi. True or false? Hands up, true? Hands up, false. What do you reckon? I reckon the truths have got it. It's a true story. And I said to Reuben at the ripe old age of seven, "Mate, your fishing stories, it's all downhill from here." He got on Scott Levi's program, The Big Fish. So Scott interviewed me about this great kind of landing of this fish. Here's my point. If this wasn't the truth, how many fishing stories would you believe of mine in the future? I kind of had a very similar experience with one of the guys who runs the myriad numbers of fishing programs that we have on the radio and on the television. I know him, and he said let's go out fishing one day. And I thought, magnificent. I'll find the secret spots. I'll learn about the gear. We'll catch a haul of fish. And we had about 4 hours on the water, and we caught a brim and a whiting. It was a really disappointing day. All the kind of planets had aligned. And I went home most disillusioned. And I tuned into the program the next week, and you wouldn't believe the haul of fish that we'd caught the previous week. We'd caught flatties, we'd caught crabs, we'd caught whiting, we'd caught brim, this whole haul of fish. It was amazing. And a really interesting thing happened in me after that. I hardly ever listened to his program again. Because I think if I can't believe that, what on earth can I believe on this particular program? Truth and trust actually do matter to all of us. I actually think it's a really rare thing for a talk like this at a church event to actually deal with an issue that is relevant to 100% of us every day of our lives, the way truth and trust does. And in every one of our relationships. Worker to boss, boss to worker, journalist to readers, broadcaster to audience, friend to friend, politician to his or her community or electorate or society. When we eat, when we drive, when we fly, when we buy. We trust that the people who are selling us this stuff, we trust that it's safe and credible to fly and buy and drive. That it's safe. We need to trust them. In a family, you imagine the relationships in a family if no one could trust each other. Husband to wife, wife to husband. Put yourself in that position. Dad to son, dad to daughter, mother to son, mother to daughter. I think it's not going too far to say that whatever the relationship, but especially in a family unit, if you have not trust and truth, you have next to nothing on which to build any kind of relationship. Like the story that is told, I trust apocryphally about a father who takes his son to the playground, climbs up the big climbing frame with him, and says to the son, "Son, you stay there, the kid's about three." And the father goes down on the ground, stands under the climbing frame and says to his son, "Son, jump, I'll catch you." And the son, the kid, three, his face goes white, he's terrified. He said, "Dad, no, it's too high. Son, trust me, I'm your father, I'll catch you." "Dad, no, I'm scared. It's too high. You might drop me." "Son, I'm strong. You know. Trust me. Jump." And there's this frozen moment of time where the kid looks at his dad, looks at how high he is, and then he falls forward and falls off. And his father steps to the left. And his kid falls to the ground. And when the tears of past, the kid says, "Dad, why didn't you catch me?" And he said, "Son, I was just teaching you one of the most valuable lessons of life, that you must trust no one." I think, geez, Dad, thanks to the wisdom of life. Now, you wouldn't have a heart if you didn't find that story, apocryphally, somewhat jarring. And yet, I want to say that's kind of the society in which we are living today when it comes to truth and trust. I remember just a year ago, to my shock, yes, even as a journalist, hearing that the Oxford Dictionaries had declared the term post-truth to be the word of the year. Then this man came along with his fake news. That's what I reckon he's saying there with his favourite enemy, CNN, in the background. Now, notwithstanding the fact that I've spent 40 years in broadcast journalism, I'm a journalist. I'm the first to admit and know about the fact that the media has never covered itself with any glory whatsoever when it comes to issues of truth and trust. I could tell you some stories. But Donald Trump and his dynamic of fake news has, in my strong view, flushed any notion of public truth and public trust down the toilet. And it leaves us in a terrible state. Fake news first came into being in the presidential election when stories on social media, mostly coming out of Russia, against Hillary Clinton were put up. Absolute 100% crap, but they went up. And the theory was that if you got one of those stories to last for 36 hours, people would accept and believe the fake to be fact. That's where fake news was begun. Then post Donald Trump's inauguration, there was this story, I don't know whether you ever saw it. There's a story about the different crowds that were attending Donald Trump's inauguration on the right as opposed to Barack Obama's on the left in 2009. You can see which is the biggest crowd. It is Barack Obama's. Donald Trump's was a distant second. And yet, the hapless and hopeless White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who's gone already, at his very first White House press briefing, got up and said, Trump's was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period. It's just not the truth. And then it led to this really very revealing moment of television journalism between NBC and Donald Trump's special counselor, Kellyanne Conway. Have a listen to this.
And you did not answer the question.
You did not answer
the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. Zeke Miller, four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
What a stunning moment of TV journalism. Alternative facts. That's the era in which we live. The US news outfit Politico did a research on Donald Trump's campaign speeches and interviews during the campaign. And a week's worth, they concluded that he uttered a mischaracterization, exaggeration or falsehood every 5 minutes on average. When caught lying red-handed, Trump resorts to weasel words and blame shifts like his all-purpose classic, all I know is what's on the internet. And I think, God help us if we really believe that all of what's on the internet is true. So now we live in this era of post-truth, alternative facts and fake news. Here's where it's all too frequently leading. And this is my last illustration from the world of journalism, but it's quite an eye-opener. Just happened a couple of weeks ago. This is what's more and more happening when politicians get into a tussle with those troublesome kind of journalists. This is a guy called Peter Hoekstra, who Trump has just appointed as the US ambassador to the Netherlands. And just a couple of weeks ago, he was in this interview with a Dutch journo about his claims of the presence of the Islamic movement in the Netherlands. So have a listen to the interview. And have a listen carefully to where it goes. Very revealing.
At one point, you mentioned in a debate that there are no-go zones in the Netherlands and that cars and politicians are being set on fire in the Netherlands.
I didn't say that. That is actually an incorrect statement. We would call it fake news.
Is that
fake never
news?
Said
because
that.
Because it's what but you actually said.
No, it's not what I said.
The Islamic movement is now gotten to a point where they have put Europe into chaos. Chaos in the Netherlands, there are cars being burned. There are politicians that are being burned. Yes, there are no-go zones in the Netherlands.
You call it fake news, obviously.
I didn't call that fake news. I didn't use the word this today.
No?
No. I don't think I did.
Yes, you did. I just heard it. I'm sure you just heard it. It's amazing. I love the way the journo turns around and thinks, which reality am I living in? It's what you call a gotcha moment. Barefaced, naked, unashamed. He's an ambassador and he's a liar. I'll leave it to Jack Nicholson for the last word.
You can't handle the truth.
Too right. Even journalists are acknowledging this crisis of truth in our society. It's a most revealing and insightful quote from Catherine Viner, the editor-in-chief of The Guardian. She says, "This year is made very clear that we cannot agree on what truths are. And when there's no consensus about the truth and no way to achieve it, chaos soon follows." So I reckon it's really important to ask, where are we in our society, in our communities, if we can't have truth and trust? But into all of this, in another quite jarring and arresting moment, one man has come, one man only, who declares about himself, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." If you don't know who it is, it's not Donald Trump. Yet. They are the words of Jesus Christ, the great British author. C.S. Lewis categorizes that kind of claim as coming from either a liar, a lunatic, or Lord. Now, I could go on for ages mounting very credible arguments about why this man is the way, the truth, and the life, this Jesus Christ. In my own life, I could tell you quite honestly, he has literally saved me from myself. In history, no serious historical scholar in ancient history would deny the truth of the reality and the existence of Jesus Christ, and that miraculous things happened around him. In terms of documentary evidence about this guy, it is second to none in ancient and modern history. Second to none. It's important to say this. While Jesus' followers and the Christian church have been responsible for monstrous behaviour over too many years, and we sure know about that today, about which they should hang their heads in shame, it's also the truth that his followers down through the millennia have in his name been responsible for towering acts of kindness and compassion and care and courage and self-sacrifice and mercy and even martyrdom. Such is the impact of this man. And I've got to say, as I reflect back on 40 years of broadcast journalism at a professional level, as I've reported on a frequently great and glorious world and great and glorious people, and also a world and people who are just plain bad, sad, and or mad, the Bible sketch of life as we know it actually adds up. It's in all the world's order, its beauty, its failings, its high points, its low points. The Bible's account of life is real, it is very often raw, and the world as we know it, if you want the good, the bad, and the ugly, it's the truth. It stacks up. So I could go on with all these fine-sounding arguments for the rest of the night. But I want to take you to one little snapshot of history to show how this actually works. This man who says he's the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus has come, turned the world as they know it upside down. Notwithstanding all the great things that he did and the great things that he said, it was just too much for the politicians of the day, and especially, and revealingly, the religious leaders. You know, it's the religious leaders who had him crucified. So they send him off to be executed, crucified, on a hill called the Skull, just outside of Jerusalem. On either side of him, being crucified with him, are two thieves. As each of their lives ebb away, there's this really pretty remarkable and very, for us, revealing conversation between these three men. In Luke's historical account of this event and this moment in the Gospel of Luke in the Bible, it goes like this. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at Jesus. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you're under the same sentence. We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise." What a moment. Can you imagine it? And in that moment, surely the stakes can't be higher on whether this man could trust that this Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life. I mean, if he wasn't, would it not be the cruelest con of all as this poor sucker's life ebbs away? What a promise to hold out. But he does. If Jesus is the truth, this man's destiny and eternity is immediately transformed from being the grubby little thief that he was to an eternity of utter glory, secured and safe. Today you'll be with me in paradise. It's important to say two things. First, each of these men had a choice that they could make. It's a stark choice. It's a serious choice. It's their choice. Jesus wasn't and never does force himself on anyone. Second thing to say is this gift of eternal life to this thief is based on nothing that he either is or has done. As I said, he's a grubby thief. What's he deserve? It's based on nothing that he has done, only an exercise of faith on his behalf and a grace on Jesus' behalf. Now, I'm not going to call anybody a criminal or a thief here, but aren't we all of us in kind of the same position still today as these blokes either side of Jesus? Our destiny for eternity rests on a similar stark and serious choice that we make about this man Jesus. If you've never been in this moment where this choice has been laid before you before tonight, or if you've never seriously considered this choice, maybe tonight's the night. And no matter what choice you make to be with this man or not, you will walk out of here a different man tonight as a result of facing the choice and making it or not. We have every right to hurl our own insults at this man and go it alone. Or we could, as an exercise of faith, well grounded, I'd say, accept that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and follow him. Now, within an hour or so, each of these three men have died. Their life expired. The story could well have ended there. I've often wondered what it would have been like to be part of Jesus' tiny little scared bunch of followers on that night. So few left after the three rollicking years of his life amongst them. It's all come to this. But it's not the end of the story. Again, the historical record has him as a matter of eyewitness accounts, hundreds of eyewitnesses in the coming weeks, physically rising from the dead and being among them 3 days later. I'd say that the faith exercised by that thief as his life ebbed away was probably the best call that he'd ever made in his life. I'd say to him, better late than never. And from there, that tiny scared bunch of Jesus followers go on to speak about this life and live it out so that within 300 years it becomes the official religion of the entire Roman Empire. And 2,000 years later, we're still talking about it, and it's still transforming the lives of countless numbers of men and women around the world. It is an enormous thing for anyone to say about themselves, I am the way, the truth, and the life. The test is, does he deliver? In that moment, at the place that they call a skull, Jesus Christ delivered that thief from death to life. The other thief had every right to hurl his insults and go it his own way, as he tragically did. And ever since then, billions of people, 4 billions of people, Jesus has delivered, as we would say in Australia, in spades. Which leaves us all tonight with a simple and stark and serious choice. In a world that I say is adrift in a sea of alternative facts and fake news and post-truth, he continues to be the way, the truth, and the life. For people like Min and Tim, again, two people not famous, you would never have heard about these two. Just everyday people who I interviewed for a marriage course that I'm producing for a DVD series that's coming out this year. Theirs is an epic story of love and commitment against all the odds. I'll give you the executive summary. They met in a Goulburn supermarket. She was 26, he was 41. He's a local cop. She works in a cafe. She's reaching up in the supermarket to get a container of detergent from the top shelf, brings it all down upon her. He's behind her, has a good old chuckle. She's embarrassed. He helps her pick it up. They get chatting within 5 minutes. How's this? He's got a number. And as he walks away, she says, "You must delete that number," which he doesn't do. She studiously avoids him, steadfastly avoids him. He waits for her, waits and waits and waits, ends up moving from Goulburn to the Gold Coast, where they meet once, talk for ages, and keep in touch. They married 18 months later. But for a whole host of reasons, the marriage goes sour. He finds another woman online and pursues her with Min's permission. Min's dad was a church minister. She grew up as a church minister's kid. Hated it. Hated church, hated God. Too many pressures, too many unrealistic expectations from Christians. But as the marriage dissolved on the rocks, she started to go back to God and go back to church. And Tim saw in her the beautiful changes that it started to make in her life, their marriage, that he said, "I'd like to start going to church with you," for the first time in his life, which he did. And pretty soon after that, he came up to his father-in-law, the church minister, and said, "I'd like to follow this Jesus." And today, they are utterly and genuinely transformed people, with an entirely new lease on life. In the interview that I did with them, Tim said, "I feel I stand tall with God, walk strong with Jesus, and I feel eternal in the Holy Spirit." The last grab of this interview is Min saying this through tears. "I'm still speechless. I've got my husband back twice, in the sense that I've got him in this life and I've got him in the next." If you haven't known that kind of transformation, which is very real, as has happened in the lives of Min and Tim and countless people around this globe, as I said before, tonight might be the night for you. We all face that choice, a stark choice, a serious choice, about whether we do life with the very author of life, Jesus Christ, or go it alone, which is our every right. As I said, if you've not faced this choice before, or if you've never seriously thought about it, this might be the moment for you to consider that kind of destiny for this life and for eternity. I have no doubt Steve and numbers of people here would be very happy to talk with you till the cows come home about it. And I'd be very happy to hang around here for as long as it takes to explain why and how this could be the first night of the rest of your life. I'm really glad to be here and really grateful for your listening. Thanks very much for having me.